addiction, you know. That's not the lamp I'm going to talk about this morning, but it seemed appropriate for this morning. But anyway, I have a prediction about this upcoming year. For the first time, I'm going to predict for the first time since 2011, we're not going to have anyone, Lori and I are not going to have anyone in our family get married. Because we don't have any more unmarried kids. We had one in 2012, one in 2013. And I'm mostly overjoyed because both of our kids married great people that we love to death. I also am overjoyed because I won't have to pay for any more weddings. And that's a really good news. But I've been thinking about weddings. Weddings, you know, they're events full of symbolism. We all know the tradition that the groom is not supposed to see the bride before the wedding. Do you know where that came from? It's not what I initially thought. I did a little research on this. It originated with back in the day when people had arranged marriages, when their marriages were arranged for them by a parent. And in many cases, the groom wouldn't even know the bride that he was going to be marrying. That's right. Oh, dear. And so the groom wasn't supposed to see the bride before the wedding because there was a little bit of concern that he might not like what he see and he might bolt. That's where that came from. It's not nearly as romantic as you thought, right? On the other extreme, in many cultures, there are some exceptions, but in many cultures and in our culture, when the bride and groom stand before the pastor to get married, the groom stands on the right. And do you know why that is? Why he's on the right and the bride's on the left? It is so that the groom can have his sword hand free in case he needs to fight off any jealous rivals. That's where that came from. So there you go. Weddings have lots of traditions. They are wonderful things. I've been thinking about weddings because I want to talk this morning about a wedding. Something had happened at a wedding a long time ago. This is, you know, a unique event that I really would have liked to be at to see what happened. And I'm talking about this because of what we're celebrating this week. You know, we're celebrating the birth of Jesus of Nazareth this week, Christmas. But the reality about that is that that event only has significance because of what happened later in his life. We don't ever understand the significance of that birth until we understand what happened later in his life. And this wedding that we're going to study today, something happened at this wedding that was crucial to who this person was and what he was here to do. It was the first glimpse of what this person's life was all about. 30 years before this wedding, there was this momentous occurrence. A young Jewish woman gives birth to a baby boy in the city of Bethlehem, not far from Jerusalem. The woman wasn't famous, powerful, rich. She and her husband were humble, poor people that the larger world knew nothing about whatsoever. The birth of her child typically would have caused no notice. She ends up giving birth to her child in the place where a family kept their animals because there was no place else for them. Though there was seemingly nothing special about that event, on the surface of it, it turns out to be the turning point in human history. Prior to that event, the records tell us angels, messengers from heaven, had actually appeared both to the mother and to her husband-to-be, explaining the meaning of this child's birth. Foreign religious leaders, apparently drawn by some unique astronomical events, arrive after the birth of the child to honor him. Shepherds, just doing their thing, they're out at night, watching over their sheep. Angels appear to them and say, "An amazing thing has happened. I bring you great news of great joy. This baby is born. Go and see him in Bethlehem." All who witnessed the events, the parents, the shepherds, the foreign leaders, were amazed at all that had happened. And after that, nothing. For 30 years. The foreign religious leaders never heard another word about the baby. The shepherds, nothing. They probably, many of them, died, never knowing what that was all about. The mother and father returned to their home eventually and raised their family in total anonymity. This event, this seemingly momentous event that had happened 3 decades ago, now has faded almost from memory. You know, I mean, after all, how much can you remember from 1983? Not much. But now we fast forward 30 years, and this baby has grown up. For all intents and purposes, he seems to be nothing unusual. His dad training him in the woodworking business. He's a very good woodworker. And everyone who knew him admitted that of all the human beings they knew, he was the best. He was good at everything he did, and he was just such a good person. But that's it. Just a guy. Suddenly, he begins thinking, I should go around and preach. And he starts going around preaching. And he's a winsome, intelligent, witty, insightful speaker with a quick wit. And people are just drawn to him. Because from him, they're hearing a message of hope, even for the most downtrodden. And there's insight into God's truth and into people that they've never heard before. And already he has garnered for himself a little handful of followers. About 5 or 6 at this point. But still, at this point, he's not much more than a curiosity. You know, he's some country bumpkin, not really known outside of his kind of basically backwards area. The intelligentsia of his culture know nothing of him. They could care less about him. He's just some rabble-rouser out in the countryside that will be a flash in the pan and disappear soon. At least, that's how he appears until the event that we look at today. The event is found in the book of John, chapter 2, beginning of verse 1. There we read these words. On the 3rd day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there. Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, they have no more wine. Woman, why do you involve me? Jesus replied, my hour is not yet come. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. They did so. The master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside. He said, everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you've saved the best until now. What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. So we see here he's at a wedding, and there's a crisis at the wedding. He is at a wedding that probably was a, might well have been a relative, an extended family relative, maybe a cousin, because his family seems to be integrally involved in the wedding. His mother may even have been responsible for the catering. We don't know. And they have a crisis. They run out of wine. Now, there are some people I've read who suggested, well, that occurs probably because Jesus and his disciples showed up and they weren't expecting him. Read the verses. Verse 2 says, Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. They were expected. That's not the problem. Now, running out of wine in that culture was a major social gaffe. Weddings were huge back in that society. You know, you can understand this because their entertainment options back in Cana, which wasn't very far from Nazareth, were pretty limited. No TV, no movies, no concerts, no sporting events to attend. Not much to do You know, no surfing, no tennis. What do you do for fun? And you have to remember that life for these people was generally pretty hard. It was a struggle just to put food on the table day after day. So all day long, there was a boring routine. You get up early in the morning, you go out and you work physical labor all day long, preparing meals, keeping the house clean, major struggle. Getting food, you know, if you got crops, just the whole thing was hard. You work all day until you're exhausted at night, you fall into bed, and then tomorrow you get up and you do it all over again, day after day after day, with nothing to amuse you, nothing to entertain you. And then along came a wedding. Weddings were big. You know, I read that this week that the average cost of a wedding in the United States today is $28,000. Just want to let you all know that we brought the average down in our family quite a ways. The average in some places were more affluent places, the average is even higher. Santa Barbara, the average cost of weddings, $42,000. Manhattan, the average cost of wedding is $77,000. Oh, wow, glad we got no more weddings coming up. Anyway, back then, weddings were a bigger deal in their culture than they are in ours. You know, ours, when somebody has a wedding and they, you know, it's one of those that goes on for hours and hours, I think, wow, this is a little bit overdone. They had weddings that went on for days. And the reason is this was the big break from the dull, grinding routine of their lives. This was the best entertainment option they had. They had a blast at the weddings. Consider this. The Hebrews, the ancient Hebrews, looked forward to a day when Messiah would come and he would introduce his kingdom on this earth. It would be this idyllic kingdom of peace and prosperity and power for Israel. And the interesting thing about that is that they pictured the initiation of that kingdom as a wedding feast. Because for them, that was the best. That was the most fun they had in their entire lives. It was at the wedding. So when you had a big wedding in town and you fouled it up, that was bad. Now, you might think, oh yeah, man, they ran out of wine. What these people, would they all just get drunk at the weddings? Realize that in their day, the wine they drank had about a third the alcohol content that wine today typically would have. The kind of wine that is typical in our culture today would have been considered strong drink in their society, was frowned upon. So it wasn't really about just getting plastered. But here's the problem. Think about their drink options, their beverage options. No Pepsi, no Coke. No Dr. Pepper, no knee-high grape, orange, or any other kind, no coffee, no orange juice, no Starbucks, no vanilla mocha latte whatever grande thing, no Gatorade, no nothing except water, but oh, by the way, about the water, no ice, so it's lukewarm, and their water filtration systems, not very good, as in they didn't exist, which meant you could get sick from drinking the water. What do you drink? Wine. And they ran out. Major gaffe. In fact, in that culture, there are ancient records of families being sued by in-laws because they messed up the wedding reception. Now, there's a way to start off your marriage, you know, huh? Yeah, it's great. We got one set of in-laws suing the other because the reception didn't measure up. Yeah, boy, this is a bad situation, social situation, when they run out of wine. And somehow, like I said, Mary is clearly they are somehow related here because she seems to take responsibilities because she comes to Jesus and she says, they've run out of wine. We got to do something. Joseph probably has passed off the scene. Mary goes to Jesus because Jesus is now the eldest son who's taken on the responsibilities as the head of the family. So the second thing we'll see in this passage is that Jesus solved the problem in a spectacular fashion. His response to his mother initially is a bit confusing. You know, why do you call me? Our English text, literally the Greek text says, what to me and to you? That's all it says. And it's a bit hard to understand what that means. What to me and to you? What does that mean? You know, the problem we're dealing with here is that was probably a colloquialism. And the difficulty for us is that it's a colloquialism initially that was probably in Aramaic. That's probably what Jesus spoke to his mother. And so by the time we get it, it's been translated from Aramaic into Greek and then Greek into English, and it's an idiom to begin with. And we probably don't understand what the idiom is. So in other words, I don't really know what this meant. Like, what to me and to you? So the translators, the best they came up with is, what's that have to do with me? Not my problem. I actually don't think that's what Jesus was saying here with this colloquialism. You know, you'll notice Mary's response is to immediately turn to the servant and say, do whatever he tells you. So her understanding of whatever he was saying was that he was going to help solve the problem. There is a colloquialism in Assyrian dialect, which was another Semitic language closely related to Aramaic and Hebrew at the time, that it was very similarly worded, which meant, I understand this with you. In other words, I hear what you're saying. I see the problem. And so I think that's what Jesus said. But you'll notice he said, but oh, by the way, Mom, now is not my hour. What was that about? I think Jesus and Mary had some conversations about who he is and about what he was going to do. And she's thinking, wedding feast, Messiah, this is the time. And he's saying, Mom, I hear what you're saying. I'm going to help deal with the problem, but this isn't the time yet. I'm not going to reveal completely who I am yet, but you're going to see a little glimpse of it today. And so he proceeds to deal with the problem. He says, okay, we got these stone jars out here. Now you'll notice, it's important to notice that John says these are stone jars that were used for ceremonial cleansing or washing by the Jewish people. That's significant, you'll see in a moment. Jesus says, take those jars and fill them up with water. They do. And amazing, when he says, now dip something out of that, take it to the head waiter. It's not water anymore. It's wine. The best wine, better than they had served at the wedding yet. Six jars, each of them held 20 to 30 gallons. That meant in one fell swoop, Jesus somehow produced 120 to 150 gallons of wine. It's a lot of wine. They probably had a great party. Now, a lot of people say, you know what, that's impossible. That couldn't happen. This is just a legend. John was there. John was an eyewitness. He saw it happen. He said, I don't know how that happened, but it happened. But that's impossible. Yeah, if you start with the premise that the supernatural cannot happen, that is impossible. There is no possible natural way for water to become wine. That's not possible. But the question is, could God make that happen? You know what? If you went into a gym and you see a really big guy in there, and he's over there, he's doing bench presses. And you look, and he's got huge stacks of weights on that bar. Boom! 400 pounds. Boom, boom. Wow, guy's strong. Would you go over to him and say, well, sure, you can bench press 400 pounds, but I bet you can't pick up that 5-pound dumbbell. Are you kidding me? If he could bench press 400 pounds, picking up a 5-pound dumbbell, he could do that with his finger. Easy. So here's the thing. If God could create all that exists out of nothing, is it that big a deal to make one fluid become a different kind of fluid? Not much of a problem, is it? Okay, nice story. What is that? It's Christmas. Why are you talking about that? Well, you'll notice that John says this was a sign. What do you know about signs? Some of them are stupid. Well, yeah, we'll see those occasionally. But what we know about signs is they tell us something. They give us information. John says this act that Jesus did was a sign. It was intended to communicate something to us. What was it intended to communicate? What does it tell us? Well, I'm going to point out three things. And the first is that Jesus is the powerful Lord of all. Jesus has been an excellent woodworker, an unusually good child growing up. Nothing uniquely remarkable about him. And there are many who would insist today, well, that's all he was. He was a great human being. But you have to ask, first of all, there have been a lot of great human beings who have existed in the world. Some of them we even honor with special days. We have President's Day to honor some great human beings. We have Martin Luther King Jr. Day to honor a great human being. Would you compare what happens in our culture on Martin Luther King Jr. Day or on the President's Day with what happens at Christmas? What happens at Christmas in our culture is an entirely different league altogether, isn't it? I mean, people start singing different songs and they play different music even in the stores, and we decorate our homes and we put lights everywhere and we give people presents and our whole culture grinds to a halt. That says, wait a minute, there's something going on here that's way more than just a really good person. And the point of this incident is that, yes, Jesus was a really good person, but he was way more than that. Because no matter how good a person may be and how powerful and strong he is, no human being has power over nature. But Jesus Christ, in this one little incident, for the very first time, has demonstrated power over nature. Prior to this point, even his followers are thinking, wow, this guy's got lots of insights. He's really connected into God. We know he knows stuff that nobody else knows. And they've seen him do one or two little things. They think, wow, how did he do that? How did he know that? Don't know. For the first time, their eyes pop open as they go, whoa, wait a minute. He just changed nature. He has power over nature itself. Who can do that? It's only one being. That's God. Human beings, we actually do some amazing things, don't we? I mean, we have created machines that, at least for a period of time, defy gravity and can fly. I mean, you ever just go down to the airport and you look at those things and you go, how does that get off the ground? It's big and heavy, that airplane. It's huge. I was talking to John DeGrasse. He just got back from India. And John was on an airplane that had 800 people on it. The thing flew. Amazing. We have amazing things that we can do. We can reproduce pictures and sounds and music through the air. That's pretty amazing. But we don't control nature itself. We don't control weather systems. I wish I could. little bit of, you know, 75 to 80 degrees every day would be just perfect. Doesn't work that way, does it? We don't control those things. Jesus demonstrates he has the power even to control nature, a power that later on he would demonstrate in a myriad of ways, by healing people and by giving blind people sight and by multiplying food and by controlling weather systems and ultimately by defeating death itself. Funny thing happened to me on my way to this sermon. I was working at my desk at home on this sermon, and I have a desk lamp. It's not that lamp. It's just a desk lamp. It sits on my desk. Lori was downstairs teaching. This was late in the day. It was getting kind of dark, so I had the lamp on. And all of a sudden, the desk lamp blinked off, and then it just went back on. And I thought, huh, why'd that happen? And then it happened again. Went off, came back on. Huh, I thought, well, maybe the bulb is loose or something. So the bulb was tight, you know. And then it happened again. I thought, are we having a little power surge, a power outage or something? But no, all the rest of the electrical stuff was working fine. And then it started just blinking on and off real quickly. And just, it was like, and it was really, I'm trying to study here. And this thing's going, bah, 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 and it's like, ah, what's going on? And I just said, this is really annoying. I guess this lamp is just going out or something. I was just about to turn it off when I suddenly went, wait a minute. Is that a pattern that I'm seeing here? And I paid attention. It was blinking off, on, off, on. And I began to think, could that be Morse code? Somebody sending me a message? And I started paying attention, and I started writing it down. And it said, tell them about the lamp. Can you believe that? No, you shouldn't. It didn't happen. The blinking on and off, that happened. It's the only time I've ever had any trouble with that lamp. After that, it stopped doing it. It's been fine ever since. Like, what was that about? I think it was about God saying, you know, Rick, if I wanted to send you a message through this lamp, I could do that. I'm not doing it, but I could do that because I control nature. And that would have been a miracle because I don't know Morse code. If I'd been able to, that would have been a miracle. God has power. He could do that if he chose to do so. In fact, we read the scriptures because they are essentially God saying, I'm going to supernaturally send you a message, and I have the power to do that through even through human beings. Ephesians 3:20 says, God is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine. Now, I want you to think about that for a moment. God's not able just to do more than we ask. He's able to do more than we even imagine he could do. So you think of your, what could, you know, could God send a Morse code message through a lamp? Well, he can do way more than that. Immeasurably more than you could even imagine. God is not limited. And this little incident at this wedding was the first sign that Jesus has that power. God has power over nature. I was talking to Lori recently about a particular situation. You know, I said, yeah, you know what, Lori, that's just hopeless. And then it hit me. Except for one thing. If God acts, there's hope, even in this seemingly hopeless situation. If it's up to just human beings and what human beings can do, it's hopeless. But it's not up to that, ultimately. God can act. And if God is in it, there's always hope. There was no hope, for instance, that human beings could overcome the problem of their guilt before God. This was the problem. God said, oh, okay, you want to have a relationship with me? Here are the rules. And nobody could keep the rules. We can't get close. How are we going to get God to accept us? Jesus has come in this incident, and he's already announced by this act that he did at this wedding what he's about to do. How do you see that? Remember John said he made a specific note. Those stone jars were for ceremonial washing. The deal was that the Jews said, well, the normal clay pots that they use could be contaminated by something, but not stone jars. And so you can only use these stone jars to store water in to wash yourselves to be clean before God. Jesus says, you know what? I'm going to take those stone jars and fill them with something that's brand new. Something that hasn't ever happened before. And it's going to be filled to the brim. And what he's saying is, that whole process of becoming clean before God, I'm replacing it with a whole new system. Something that depends not upon your ability, but upon my ability to provide. And what I provide will be sufficient for you. Our greatest problem, Jesus is saying, I'm about to solve. In a symbolic way, he's already showing his disciples something brand new is going to happen, and it's going to be what I provide in my power and my grace that will be enough, and it will be more than enough for you. This is an amazing statement that we can trust in what God provides for us to have a relationship with him, to be forgiven, to have hope for eternity, and then for every situation we face, we can know that if God is in it, there's always hope because God has power even over nature and he can do anything in this world. That's an amazing thing that Jesus has said here in this little act. But there's more. Second thing I want you to see is that Jesus cares about the details of your life. How do you get that? John says this was the first miracle Jesus did. And all it accomplished was to save a young couple from being embarrassed. Did you think about that? I mean, he didn't save anybody's life. He didn't heal anybody. I mean, all he did was these people were going to be in a really embarrassing social situation, and Jesus said, ah, I can take care of that. Why that as his first miracle? You know, heal cancer, feed the hungry, do something really big. You could understand that, but, you know, let's make sure these people aren't embarrassed. Was this like, you know, sort of warming up? You know, going to use a little low-power miracle here to start off with because I want to make sure we've got this calibrated right. I don't want to blow nature's circuits, you know. Do something little to start off. Yeah, okay, we're good. Is that what's going on? Or was this just sort of an offhand thing? Should I do a miracle today? Yeah, how about some wine? Nah, no problem. No. This is intentional. What does it tell us? It tells us that what happened in that young couple's life mattered to Jesus. He cared, and he wanted to help them in a difficult situation. That's amazing. Jesus cared. Do you think of Jesus like that? Do you think he actually cares about the little insignificant events of your life? This incident says he cares deeply about us. In fact, 1 Peter 5:7 says, cast all your anxiety on him, on God, because he cares for you. Oh, okay, so that's like cast all your worries about the really big things in life on God. No. What does he say? Cast all your anxiety upon God. Even about the little things. Well, even I'm uptight about, you know, Lori was making date bread and it didn't come out quite right the first batch. Does God care about that? Well, it's an all. It's part of all. God apparently cares. You know, you might object, well, that's absurd to think that God, the Almighty God, could possibly care about the minutiae of my life. You know, it's interesting. I've noticed how my brother Jerry and his wife Annie and my mother are full of reports about the adventures of their granddaughter and great-granddaughter Addison. You know, I got to ask you, are you waiting with bated breath to hear about her fascination with Karen, the little girl from the Frosty the Snowman TV show, or about her obsession with Thomas the Tank Engine? You know, the world goes, yeah, nah, it doesn't matter. But they care. It matters to them because they love her. And even those little tiny details matter. I was thinking about that. I was reminded of a time when our daughter, Chris, was about two. And I was working at home. Chris had wandered in from my stadium. I was sitting at my desk. She crawled up my lap. I'm trying to do a little work, and she opened the drawer, and pulls out a pen, and sets it on the desk, and then closes the drawer. And then she looks at me, and I think, look what I did. That's very good. You did a really good thing there. And then she opened the drawer, closed the drawer.
That was really good, Chris.
And then she did it again. Get it out. Really good. She did it over and over and over.
You know how kids do that? They get into doing something, and they do it over and over again. They get so cool. And it's like, I'm thinking,
I've got to distract her, because otherwise I'm going to spend the rest of my afternoon going, yes, Carissa, that's wonderful. Now put it back. Yes. No. So I did distract her.
And after she left, I started thinking about that. That's so funny. You know, she got so old. This seemed such a big deal to her.
And then it was like the Lord just spoke and said,
yeah, right, that's not like you.
You do all these things, and you think they are such a big deal.
And frankly, they don't really, most of them have much more meaning than taking the pen out and putting them to put it back.
The world doesn't really care about all that you get all so uptight about, and it doesn't really matter. And you look at the eternal scope of things, how much difference? What you're doing and you're so uptight about, is anybody going to know about it 100 years from now?
No.
Does it really matter that much? I'm like, my daughter. And here's the thing. I paid attention to my daughter doing a meaningless thing because I love her. And all of a sudden it hit me. Oh, God loves us. And so he cares even about the trivia and the minutia and the meaningless little things that we get so uptight about. He says, I care. It matters to me.
Is that really true?
Jesus said in Matthew 10:29, are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from the will of your Father. You know, Lori loves her birds. We have to, we get to go to the market every week, and I've got to buy a 20-pound sack of bird seed to put out, because the birds will starve, So we have a bird feeder, and we got all these birds flying around. And so we got, finches and sparrows and wrens and robins and doves and, even an occasional hawk and, all the orioles and crows. And I see them out there, and it's cute. It is kind of fun having the birds out there, Not real fond of the crows. Ah, ha! Nice bird song. Yeah. But anyway, see them out there. I don't know who they are, what they do. It's like they see them, they come and they go. I don't know if one of them loses a spouse or something. Doesn't matter to me. God says, I know every one of those birds. And I know when one of them has a bad day, has a heart attack and dies, I know about that. Now, if I know every one of those little birds, Rick, don't you think I know about what's going on in your life and care? It's Jesus' point. He knows. And he demonstrated his care here with this young couple just married. He says, it matters to me what happens in your life. Everywhere we go in life, isn't this great? God goes with us, and we can talk to him about it, and he actually cares about it. He cares about what happens in your life and my life, even the small things. Because after all, which of the things that we do is big to God? None of them to him. It's power over nature. So whatever we face is big or small to us, doesn't matter. To God, they're about the same. And he cares about all of it. He wants us to bring all of it to him and talk to him about all of it and trust it all with him and to know that even though we may not understand why some of the things happen in our life, we know that God cares about it and we're never alone in it. Isn't that great? That's what he's telling us in this little story. One more thing that's really important, and that is that Jesus can make the ordinary special. What went into those jars? You know, I was thinking about that then. I remember a time several years ago. It was really funny. Lori was a really hectic time. She was really distracted, and she was very tired. There was just haggard because there's a lot going on. And this was when Toby was living at home one time, and he came home. We were about to eat, and he's sitting down at the table. He says, "Hey, Mom, can I have some water?" And she said, "What kind?" And he was kind of stumped for a second. He goes, "Well, the kind with 200 atoms and one oxygen atom, you know. What kind? What kind of water went into those jars? H2O, plain H2O. What came out? Something extraordinary." Jesus is saying, "I can do something extraordinary with something very ordinary." This story is preceded in John's account, chapter 1, by Jesus is beginning to ask a handful of guys to be his disciples. Do you know who he picked? Some fishermen. Guys that were nobodies. You're going to start this big new movement. It's going to change the world. It's going to be the most significant thing the world has ever seen. And you pick some bumpkins? Just guys from nowhere who there's nothing special about them? They're just ordinary. That's who Jesus picked. Why? Because he wanted us to understand that he can take ordinary people and do something extraordinary with them. He can take water, ordinary water, and turn it into the best wine that has ever existed. Acts chapter 4, Peter and John, two of the men that Jesus picked as disciples, are being tried by the elite of their society. And Peter and John are just stymieing them, the most brilliant people in their culture, at every turn. And finally, it says in verse 13 of Acts 4, when they saw the courage of Peter and John and realized they were unschooled, ordinary men, they were astonished and they took note that these men had been with Jesus. Ordinary guys, and Jesus turned them into something extraordinary. You know, when I talk about that, I think most people think in terms of, well, so we got to be something really extraordinary and we got to lead big, huge ministries and change the world or take power and do really dramatic things. I don't think that's really the point. Imagine a person so secure in who he or she is that it's nearly impossible to offend that person. You can say or do anything and they'll still love you and respond to you just the same. Imagine a person so full of love for God, so focused on his will and his glory, that this person doesn't really care about his or her own comfort, about being noticed, about whether people reach out and meet his or her needs. They just care about God being glorified. Imagine a person so full of God's grace and forgiveness that he just floods other people with it. Imagine a person so full of hope that on the darkest of days, this person just is a tower of strength for other people because of the hope that's there. Imagine a person who just is a constant source of encouragement for other people, never gives us a hint of bitterness or resentment. This person wouldn't deny pain or disappointment, in the middle of it would still have joy. I submit to you that that person would be extraordinary. And that's exactly what God wants to produce in ordinary people like us. What we can take from this passage is to remember that that little baby that was born in that stable grew up to become a man who had power over nature, power to accomplish anything we can imagine, and who wants to pour kindness and strength and love and grace into our lives, that he's present with us in everything that happens, and that he wants to use us to impact other people. Well, how do we make that happen? Well, here's what we should do. We should listen to the words of Mary to the servants. Do whatever he tells you.